classified documents demonstrate this training to be something of a farce. She apparently didn't need to learn how to draw ideograms or identify gestalts or make clay models of things she perceived. When given a long-distance target to remotely view, Della Fiora closed her two eyes, opened her self-described third eye, and in a matter of minutes arrived at DIA's target site. This made operations managers and taskers uncomfortable. Starting in November 1986, operations officer Eugene Lessman and Fred Atwater took turns monitoring Della Fiora. Lessman went first. A former Special Forces soldier with two tours of duty in Vietnam, his disdain for the occult was as palpable as his hard-charging personality. Large and burly, with a signature handlebar mustache, he liked to talk about Vietnam. On his last mission in the war theater, he was ferrying a Viet Cong intelligence asset back to Da Nang when the man revealed himself to be a double agent and opened fire inside the helicopter. With the pilot dead and Lessman seriously wounded, the aircraft was crashing. Putting his quick reaction training to use, Lessman killed the Viet Cong fighter and crash-landed the helicopter at the airbase. Lessman was happy to show his torso full of bullet scars to anyone who asked about Vietnam, Paul Smith recalls. Now he was tasking Angela Della Fiora on a remote viewing session. He and the other soldiers had devised a plan to mold her into a good remote viewer. Privately, they called her a witch. The remote viewing room had been designed as a monotone environment, free of distraction. The walls were gray, the carpet was gray, and so were the desk and chairs. The room was wired for sound. The viewer sat in a relaxation chair, which was part chaise lounge and part dental chair. Wires connected the viewer to equipment that tracked physiological data, including respiration, temperature, and pulse. Across the hall, in the monitoring room, the tasker sat in front of a rack of television monitors, microphones, and audio and video recording equipment. In this case, Della Fiora sat in the viewing room wearing headphones through which Lessman communicated from the monitoring room. As he worked this Global Beacon target session, Lessman took notes that are now declassified. "Start time, 10 a.m., wrote Lessman in the log. He spoke into the microphone. "This is a man-made object at 37 degrees, 24 minutes, 31 seconds north. 122 degrees, 10 minutes, 41 seconds. Begin your relaxation now. When you arrive at your sanctuary, you must tell me," he instructed. Sanctuary was a Fort Meade term for a metaphorical place of safety, somewhere in the Matrix where a viewer was to travel first, not at Fort Meade and not at the actual target site. Lessman continued, "I will provide you the coordinates again from your sanctuary," he said. "This will be your cue to go to the target and begin describing your impressions. Remember to relax your body completely from foot to head and prepare that thing you call a third eye for the task at hand." Lessman and the others had such disdain for Angela's third eye that they could only refer to it as that thing you call a third eye. In the monitoring room, Lessman opened a sealed envelope and looked at the target for the first time, a photograph that only he could see. He gave Della Fiora the coordinates again. The target was the Stanford Dish, located in the foothills near Stanford University. It was a massive 150-foot diameter radio telescope built by the Air Force to communicate with satellites. From the logs, Lessman learned that the dish was built on top of a large, rounded hill with grass in wide abundance, and that it was an antenna consisting of concentric circles in a vast array of metallic framework. These kinds of descriptions were provided so that the tasker knew what to look for in the viewer's details. In 2017, if a person were to type these coordinates into Google Maps, which did not exist in 1986, an image of the Stanford dish would almost instantly appear. It took Della Fiora 12 minutes to arrive at her so-called sanctuary location, then another 3 minutes to arrive at the target site. By November 1986, Jean Lessman had been overseeing remote viewing operations for 7 months. Most viewers spent at least 20 minutes listening to music or meditating in the relaxation chair before they were ready to begin a viewing session. Getting to the sanctuary often took a viewer 20 or so minutes, then another 15 or 20 minutes to get to the target. Not only was Angela Della Fiora fast, she was really fast. She spent the next 25 minutes describing to Lessman what she saw at the Stanford dish coordinates. His notes read, "Source described a large open area, windy with green and brown colors associated with the landmass. True. There was a feeling of isolation at this site, but it was at least visible by many people. True. The object consisted of a wide array of shapes with triangles and circles being the predominant shape. True. A general feeling of roundness, curving, and pointed curves were also described. True. An opening or center portion of the structure appears to be of importance. True. With the concepts of transference of things back and forth as prime purpose. True. And a concept of seeing without using the eyes. True. There was an impression of heat, but non-specific heat, in that it did not burn or even give off warmth. Radio waves? But rather tickled the body. Probably true." In the official declassified operations log, Lessman could not hide his awe. He'd been doing tasking operations for long enough to know that it generally took a viewer several noisy sessions to get close to receiving a good signal line. For example, in a recent session in which the target was the Great Pyramid at Giza, remote viewer 017 saw liquid, fluid, a man-made structure, a thin gray bridge. In another, in which the target was Madison Square Garden, remote viewer 023 saw hospital corridor, stone columns, and an altar inside an Egyptian temple. Most viewers training in coordinate remote viewing protocols were way off target. In hundreds of pages of declassified documents, there are a fair share of target descriptions that read like a drowning man grasping at straws. Yet, in her very first tasking session, Angela Della Fiora was getting majority signal and almost no noise. Lessman asked her to get in closer to the object and to describe the structure in more detail. Della Fiora began laughing, loud giggling, as Lessman noted in the log. "You are happy," he said. "Grass, hey," she cheered. "Tell me about your happiness." "I moved away from the structure, I'm sorry," she said. "Okay," Lessman said. "Round things make me crazy," Della Fiora explained. "Tell me its purpose," Lessman directed. "Its purpose is the opening. It's the opening," she said, and began giggling again. "You are laughing," he scolded. "I feel something tickling me." "Tell me about that," he said. I don't know. The heat is under the roundness, causing movement at me. Lessman noted in the log that Della Fiora's voice began to quiver and her body began to shake. This was the kind of occult behavior, too reminiscent of witchcraft, that the military men in the group decided must be terminated. Return now to your sanctuary, Lessman demanded, and ended the session. Still, he noted in the log that she'd done an excellent job. He graded the session as a 5 on a scale from 1 to 6. Lessman reported the results to his superior, Fred Atwater. According to the operations log, in an effort to curtail Della Fiora's occult habits, the quivering voice and shaking body, a new protocol was installed for her next session, as indicated in the operations log. For this one, the target site was the Eiffel Tower. Today, we will be working on another global beacon target, Lessman said through the microphone. One difference today needs to be discussed. Very often, you begin to shake and your voice begins to quiver. For the integrity of coordinate remote viewing protocols, said Lessman, it needs to be controlled. If it occurs again, you will hear me state, refocus. That will be a signal to stop reporting, reacquire the site, and to fix the images in your mind. You will then hear me state, continue, at which point you can continue to report. Lessman repeated, refocus. This time, it took Angela 3 minutes to get to the sanctuary, then 4 minutes to get to the target site. Okay, structure, structure, triangle, I see another triangle, she said. Describe the structure, he said. The log indicates that Angela's voice started to quiver and her body began to shake. Refocus, commanded Lessman. Angela went silent. Continue, he said. But the connection was lost. Della Fiora's signal line went dead. Nothing, she said. When shown these declassified documents in 2016, Della Fiora recalled the sessions and remembered that time in her professional life when the unit's managers and taskers worked hard to gather extrasensory information according to the military's rules. My process is my process, she says. Trying to change it isn't going to help. But still, I should have gotten the Eiffel Tower. How can you miss the Eiffel Tower? It's huge. Della Fiora's third Global Beacon session took place on November 24, 1986. She sat in the relaxation chair, and Jean Lessman read the coordinates to her from the monitoring room. I have read you the coordinates, he said. I will read them again when you reach the sanctuary. Begin your relaxation now, in preparation for your tasking. This is a man-made object. The logbook indicates that Della Fiora's target was the Great Pyramid at Giza, a huge, four-sided edifice containing numerous chambers and passageways. This ancient tomb was built as the final resting place for the 4th dynasty pharaoh, Khufu, 2800 BC, read the description in the log. At one time, the tomb contained fabulous treasures, most of which were stolen by grave robbers over the centuries. In recent history, archaeologists have uncovered several heretofore unknown chambers containing colorful hieroglyphics and a large amount of ancient artifacts, including gold and jewel-encrusted jewelry. It took Angela Della Fiora 5 minutes to get to the sanctuary, then another 3 minutes to get to the target site. And while some might argue that she simply had an amazing memory for coordinates and therefore knew this location was near Cairo, others might think she was divining information through unknown means. From the notes, we know that Lessman did not hide his surprise over the ease with which she reported what she saw and the specificity of details. Source reported a rolling, breezy, soft, warm area, which closely correlates to the general geographic description of the site. Source further stated that at this site, there are at least two structures. True. One of which is huge in its dimensions. True. Inside the structure, there are pictures of animals, designs, and faces on the wall of long hallways. A clear reference to the hieroglyphics on the walls inside the chamber. Source reported that one of the overwhelming impressions of the site is the preservation of history and culture, and that the people on the walls of the site wore unusual clothing and were noted for their culture and refinement, as well as their life of luxury and ease. True. The area, according to the source, has witnessed many wars and invasions in the area around the site. For this session, Lessman gave Della Fiora a grade of 6. It did not take long for Della Fiora to begin delivering 8 martini results. On average, she could get to the sanctuary in 3 minutes, then the target site 3 minutes after that. The taskers stopped trying to correct her hypnagogic voice and instead let her report what she saw. The following month, Branch Chief Fred Atwater ran Della Fiora on what was called a dual target, 2 locations near one another to be viewed in one session. This was a skill that was supposed to take more than a year of CRV training to acquire. The first target was a coordinate. In the monitoring room, Atwater looked at a photograph of the rustic home of Ulysses S. Grant, 18th President of the United States. Now restored, the home is a National Historic Monument located inside a tourist park near St. Louis, Missouri. The second target, 14.8 miles to the northeast, was the 630-foot stainless steel monument called the Gateway Arch. In the operations log, Atwater wrote that at Grant's house, Source began by describing a structure in a breezy, hilly area with a generally open feeling about it. This structure was correctly reported as being square, sloping, monumental, fenced in by a short, low fence, divided room, or perhaps the effect of stacked logs. The source correctly reported that the place was associated with a man and its purpose was to look, to wander about, and to view awards, medals, and displays. Source correctly associated this structure with an important person who wore a blue uniform and was associated with a terrible war. Next, Atwater noted in the log, Source was asked to switch locations and to move to the second target that was of interest to the tasker. He reported that Source correctly identified this as being high, overwhelmingly modern, 2 halves exactly like making a whole, a mirrored image, which very accurately describes the actual symmetry of the arch. Atwater was impressed. He gave Della Fiora a score of 6 and wrote, "Based on the very concise description, there can be no doubt that she was able to successfully acquire the proper sites and accurately describe the major components of the targets in such a manner that an analyst would have no difficulty in correlating these perceptions to the actual target." In an intelligence collection operation, the ability to access a site next to a site is key. For example, a viewer might be sent to a known military facility, like Semipalatinsk in the Soviet Union, then asked if there was anything of interest nearby. This concept was the result of Kit Green's first experiment that used coordinates to remotely view a target, in that case, the summer cabin of Green's colleague, a CIA clandestine officer. When Pat Price described the NSA's top-secret Sugar Grove Station facility nearby. It was because this was the far more interesting target, Price said, which is similar to what happened in Della Fiora's next Global Beacon session when she was given coordinates for the Devil's Tower in Wyoming. The Devil's Tower is a natural stone outcropping, tall, monolithic, and conical in shape. It has a flat top and striations running down the side. After arriving at this site and describing the Devil's Tower accurately, Source asked to move to something more sinister nearby and began describing some kind of underground facility, wrote Atwater in the declassified log notes. At the time, Atwater was unaware of any underground facility nearby, but he was curious about what Della Fiora might be referring to, so he encouraged her to provide further details. She described what she saw. Special areas, railings, circular, things go in there to make things occur. Domed-shaped rooms, cold, testing, controlling, innovative, shiny, new with people working around. The primary object in this facility, she said, was man-made, hard, modern, flying, tossing, turning, fenced off with a sign I can't read, special area, power. After the session ended, Atwater did an internal special access program search that showed him the locations of highly classified nuclear weapons facilities in Wyoming. A subsequent check found that in the area there are several U.S. Defense underground missile silos classified top secret that are not far from the Devil's Tower. Grade 6. In her final consecutive Global Beacon target session, Della Fiora delivered what is considered the holy grail of remote viewing, the ability to access alphanumeric data. On February 4, 1987, she was given a coordinate and told, "This is a new target. You have not seen this before." It took her 2 minutes to get to the sanctuary, then another 5 minutes to get to the target site. The target was the thoroughbred racetrack, Churchill Downs, home to the Kentucky Derby. As noted in the logs, it is a place characterized by the wearing of antebellum costumes, toasting with champagne, and eating of strawberries and cream. Once Della Fiora arrived at the target site, she described the location as a nice place where people play games. They are pretending, she said, wearing costumes, toasting with champagne. She saw food vendors and smells. People walking, people talking, animals, she said. Tall, wild animal, exotic. People get dressed up to have fun. The animals walk around. They are controlled by the people. The animals are used for the fun, to show how smart they are. Atwater asked her to describe the animals. A riding feeling, up and down, fast. When I get this riding feeling, I can feel wind and I feel I can move fast, she said. Asked for more specifics, Della Fiora said the place was called Church, Church, then Town, 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 not a far stretch from Churchill Downs. When Dale Graff and Jack Verona read the report, they knew they had a rare and unique viewer in Angela Della Fiora. They also knew they had a potential problem as far as operations were concerned. In point of fact, their best remote viewer could access reliable information because she was psychic, not because she had learned how to be psychic from a military manual. The Coordinate Remote Viewing Manual was created to teach soldiers and civilians to be psychic because the Defense Department believed such a guide would solve some of its problems with antagonistic forces within the military and the Congress who had declared the program to be voodoo warfare, hocus pocus, and occult. Government programs are designed to be egalitarian and training-based. Battlefield skills are to be taught, learned, and honed. Too much reliance on one person was not good for protocol. So a new protocol was implemented to try to smooth over these interconnected problems. It was called large-scale remote viewing and involved several individuals viewing the same target. The information was collected by the operations manager and delivered to Dale Graff. It was Graff's job to cull the information and pass it on to his boss, Jack Verona. Finally, Verona would run the information by analysts at DIA, who would help him decide what information to pass on to the client, be it the NSA, the Air Force, the CIA, or a host of other military and intelligence agencies. The year 1986 marked a significant buildup in advanced technology weapons facilities, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union. The Soviets were pursuing advanced technologies applicable to strategic defense, including laser, particle beam, kinetic energy, and microwave technologies applicable to strategic weapons, recalls Robert Gates, deputy director of Central Intelligence at the time. The scale of the effort was impressive, with more than a half a dozen major research and development facilities and test ranges. Inside the Pentagon, Gates was known to be a vocal adversary of the psychoenergetic phenomena programs, but not everyone at CIA shared his views. Between 1986 and 1988, says Graff, we did many facilities targets for the intelligence community, and with acknowledged ground truth success. Many of these facilities targets involved large-scale remote viewing efforts. At Fort Meade, several people would view the same target with coordinates provided by the client. The branch chief and operations monitor would sort through the data looking for common threads in a signal line. Viewers who delivered the most promising results would return to the target site for more information. For Project 8701, viewers were sent to coordinates located outside Dushanbe, Tajikistan, in what was then the South Central USSR. Viewers consistently reported large metal structures near a large building in a barren area with confirmed accuracy. For Project 8704, viewers were sent to coordinates where they described workers in protective clothing, containment areas, and livestock pens filled with chickens and pigs. Satellite photographs confirmed the location as a Soviet chemical and biological test site. For Project 8609, viewers were asked to gather information about a top-secret Soviet research and development facility in Kazakhstan. They described infrastructure consistent with anti-ballistic missile testing, according to declassified memos. The site was later revealed to have been Sari Shagan, an anti-ballistic missile anti-satellite systems testing range. Projects 8715, 8716, and 8717 were all facilities targets for the CIA. The detailed results of these three projects remain classified as of 2017. In Washington, Graff and Verona chaired the Remote Viewing Tasking Group for Sunstreak. Declassified memos reveal that representatives from CIA, NSA, and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency regularly attended, as did intelligence officers with the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Also present was a congressional staffer from the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. Targets included underground tunnels near the DMZ in Korea silkworm missile launch facilities in Iran, and an errant nuclear-powered Soviet satellite called Cosmos 1900. The CIA requested information on a possible mole working deep inside the agency. Declassified documents reveal that their target was Aldrich Ames, an American CIA analyst turned KGB mole. For Dale Graff, the challenge remained what it had always been: how to pare down volumes of information in order to determine what might matter. With 10 years of experience examining data, Graff believed he'd developed a sense of what was signal and what was noise. "I did not want to appear impartial," Graff recalled in 2015, "but Angela's results were consistently the best results." This meant that Graff now gave many of the high-priority targets to Della Fiora. For some of the most sensitive projects, he took trips down to Fort Meade to run Angela Della Fiora's remote viewing sessions himself. And as the number of her sessions increased, so did tensions in the unit. The remaining viewers were kept active doing remote viewing training sessions with operations manager Ed Dames. But instead of cultivating and refining tradecraft on DIA-sanctioned targets, which included over 100 landmarks, bridges, and monuments around the world, Dames began sending viewers to what would become known as anomaly or chimera targets, non-standard destinations not in DIA protocols. These targets did not exist or could not be verified, places like alien bases beneath the desert in Phoenix or on Mars. Dames's personal interest in supernatural concepts like the Akashic records, extraterrestrial visitations, and an impending apocalypse began working their way into his professional life and, by default, into the unit at Fort Meade. Joe McMonagle says of this time, "One difficulty in the study of psi, psychic functioning, is that it is not only possible to delude oneself into thinking something that isn't true, in some cases, it is highly likely. It can happen to anyone." In time, these actions would have grave consequences for the program. It was thoroughly ironic. In trying to divorce itself from the mystical and the supernatural, and by insisting remote viewing was a skill that any soldier could learn, DIA had opened the door to the irrational. For reasons that have never been explained, Dames was allowed to run wild with his anomaly targets. In an interview in 2016, Fred Atwater says he was getting ready to retire and had already been assigned to standard, outgoing administrative duties, and that he was not made aware of Dames's anomaly targets until after he left Fort Meade. Dale Graff says he was not privy to the anomaly targets until the records were reviewed at a later date. But Graff's deputy, a man by the name of Jim Salyer, raised a larger issue, one Salyer believed allowed problems such as Ed Dames's anomaly targeting to exist. In his Secret Working Papers, Salyer outlined what he called existing problems at Fort Meade. Whereas the SRI group is managed by scientists with extensive experience in understanding and researching psi, psychic, phenomena, the Army group has no one associated with it who has any understanding of psi phenomena or experience in researching or utilizing remote viewing, Salyer opined. The experienced scientists were at DIA, located an hour south of Fort Meade at the new headquarters in Washington, D.C. The unit at Fort Meade consists of Army personnel who were selected and trained to do remote viewing. Their problems are that no selection criteria were available when they submitted to an unevaluated training program, which was completed by only one member who has now left the unit, Salyer wrote, referring to Tom McNear. Essentially, what you have is a group of amateurs led by another amateur and being trained by yet another amateur. Success in any science is rarely achieved by an amateur. Hence, it is not surprising that the results produced by their group have not been astounding. The damning assessment led to a critical review of the program, says Graf. This document helped DIA establish a PSI-RV intelligence community working group with representatives from CIA, NSA, State Department, and several of the military operational commands, and eventually resulted, Graf remarks, in DIA being given control of the Fort Meade personnel. But before that occurred, the craziness would escalate. Chapter 20. The End of an Era. The mid-1980s marked the end of an era for the scientists who originally worked on anomalous mental phenomena programs for the CIA at Stanford Research Institute. Kit Green retired from CIA to work for General Motors Asia Pacific Division in China, where he became a member of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Hal Puthoff left SRI to lead a private research foundation in Texas, the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin. Jacques Vallée resigned from his contract position on the SRI team and became a venture capitalist, specializing in high technology in Silicon Valley. As general partner of Euro-America Ventures, he spearheaded the early-stage investments of what would eventually total 60 startup companies, more than a dozen of which would go public through IPOs or acquisitions. At the end of this era, while some of the pioneers of U.S. government psychic research thrived, others struggled. Apollo 14 astronaut Ed Mitchell was not faring so well. He remained deeply interested in ESP and consciousness studies, and this made him endless fodder for journalists. He began speaking out against the Reagan administration's Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, which he said could lead to the weaponization of space. The former astronauts' outspoken opposition to the president's ambitious space weapons program made him a pariah in military and defense science circles. Almost every news article about Mitchell made disparaging reference to the ESP tests he'd conducted in space. In 1985, news broke that Mitchell was involved in a paternity suit and that the child's mother was a former Playboy playmate with whom he'd been having an affair. When Mitchell denied being the father and dismissed the suit as extortion disguised as paternity, the press descended upon him. When blood tests confirmed he was the child's father, the press chastised him. In turn, he tried blaming the press for his hardship. Publicity about the case had a devastating effect on my credibility, my reputation, and most of all, my income, he said, opening the door for further criticism. If Edgar Mitchell left his footprints on the moon as an American hero, he has since become the man who fell to Earth, wrote a reporter for South Florida's Sun Sentinel. While Mitchell has been pursuing his goals for a higher understanding, he has also led a life of turmoil. He was enmeshed in 5 separate lawsuits. He was under threat of eviction. He was getting another divorce. This and more was reported in the press. I was suicidal, he told a reporter. Life had become a disaster, he lamented. The anti-ESP and PK crusader James Randi had also fallen on difficult times. In 1986, he won a MacArthur Foundation grant worth $272,000. But according to the New York Times Magazine, he burned through almost all of it in legal costs fighting libel cases brought on by Uri Geller. The organization James Randi helped found, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, told him to lay off making false statements, but Randi wouldn't stop. His campaign against Uri Geller ultimately cost him his position on PsyCop. When PsyCop board members demanded he stop discussing Geller in public, Randi resigned in fury, wrote reporter Adam Higginbotham. For Uri Geller, life was good. He had spent most of the 1970s and early 1980s in the spotlight, but by 1985, he'd become more private and family-oriented. For a while, he'd lived in a compound in Stamford, Connecticut, with his wife, Hannah, and their two young children, but had recently moved to England. He'd made a fortune divining information for petroleum and mining companies. The technique he used was map dowsing, what he'd done for Moshe Dayan in 1970. Geller's clients included Petroleos Mexicanos, or Pemex, in Mexico, Rio Tinto Zinc in England, and Xanax Limited in Australia. According to the Financial Times, Geller's map dowsing fee was £1 million, and he'd been involved in at least 11 known dowsing projects for an income total of roughly $35.75 million in 2017 U.S. dollars. He maintained contact with numerous government sources, Geller says, and on occasion assisted with FBI searches for missing persons. Then, one day in January 1987, he received a call from the State Department. The caller identified himself as being from Ambassador Max Kempelman's office in Washington, D.C., Geller says. Since 1985, Kempelman had served as head of the United States delegation to the negotiations with the Soviet Union on nuclear and space arms in Geneva. His office was calling with an unusual request, Geller remembers, and he was asked to meet with Kempelman in London for a private discussion. There is no way to independently verify the call, but photographs taken by Shippy Strang show Geller and Kempelman shaking hands outside an office building in what appears to be London. He wanted to know if I thought that a human mind could influence others at a distance in a positive way, says Geller. The following month, Geller was invited to attend a reception at the U.S. Embassy in Geneva. Also in attendance would be Soviet and U.S. arms negotiators and their wives. Negotiations between the two nuclear-armed superpowers had been going on for years, and now it seemed as if closure might finally be at hand. The goal of the talks was to eliminate the Soviets' ground-launch ballistic and cruise missiles, called Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces, or INF missiles, stationed in Eastern Europe. Presidents Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev had met 3 months before in Reykjavik, Iceland, but the talks had recently stalled. Much was riding on these Geneva disarmament talks, in which Ambassador Kempelman played a primary role. Geller was flown to Geneva and driven to the U.S. Embassy. Already present at the reception were five senators, including Al Gore, Arlen Specter, and Claiborne Pell, as well as Ambassador Kempelman and Anthony Lake, the U.S. National Security Advisor. If the press spotted me, I was told to be described as an entertainer, Geller recalls, although Who ever heard of entertainers at disarmament talks? Geller had been given a secret mission that involved Yuli M. Vorontsov, Russia's first deputy foreign minister and the lead Soviet arms negotiator in the Geneva talks, he says. Geller's instructions were to stand near Vorontsov and try to influence his thoughts in a way that would get him to sign the INF Treaty. As preposterous as it may sound, in 2009, British journalist Jonathan Margolis traveled to Claiborne Pell's home in Rhode Island and verified the story. At the reception, Geller located Vorontsov, who was engaged in a conversation with Senator Pell's wife, Nuala. Geller joined the discussion. "I liked Vorontsov at once," he recalls. "I felt no trace of hostility from him, and we soon began a pleasant and informal conversation, ranging over world affairs in general and the abilities of individuals to alter the course of events by no more than the state of their minds and their real desire for peace. Vorontsov knew who I was, and since I had been brought along as an entertainer, I thought I had better do some entertaining." Geller asked Vorontsov whether he could have his watch so that he could make the hand stop with his mind. Vorontsov refused. "So I decided to demonstrate how I could make a seed sprout in the palm of my hand by closing my palm and concentrating very hard," Geller remembers. Nuala Pell later said, "What I remember was Uri putting the grass seeds in the palm of his hand, and they grew. He did it in front of all of us. We just couldn't believe it. Everybody was floored. The Russians just looked stunned. They didn't know whether to believe it or not to believe." Finally, Geller did what he'd been asked to do by Ambassador Kempelman, he says. "I went and stood behind Vorontsov. I stared at the back of his head. I repeated in my mind, 'Sign, sign, sign.'" 7 days later, on March 6, 1987, Ronald Reagan made a statement to the world. "I have just met with Ambassadors Kempelman, Glittman, and Lehman to hear their report on the nuclear and space talks in Geneva," the president said, and added that the Soviet Union has recently offered to move ahead with an agreement to cut longer-range INF missiles. "This is something the United States and our allies have long urged." Now it had finally happened. "They signed," remembers Geller. "Of course, I would never take full credit for such a thing. But it worked, whatever it may be." 2 months later, Claiborne Pell asked Geller to come to Washington for a classified meeting on Capitol Hill. The meeting took place in the Capitol building's sensitive, compartmented information facility, which is located in the top of the rotunda. "They wanted to know about my ability to place a single thought in someone's mind. They wanted to know about what happened with Vorontsov. I showed them my abilities. I did a telepathy test with a senator. I bent a spoon." Colonel John Alexander was sitting in the front row, watching. "By now, I'd been trained by magicians on how to bend a spoon, and I'd watched James Randi's spoon-bending video frame by frame," he says. "Uri bent the spoon using no physical force. Then he laid it down on a chair a few feet in front of me and went back to talking. As he talked, the spoon continued to bend and fell on the floor," says Alexander, who picked up the spoon and took it home with him. The meeting was supposed to remain a secret, but appeared in the May 4, 1987 issue of U.S. News and World Report. In a vault in an attic of the Capitol, government officials gathered to hear Israeli psychic Uri Geller reveal what he has divined of Soviet strategic intentions, quipped a Washington Whispers columnist. Geller says that several officials asked privately whether he would meet with them discreetly in their homes. He recalls being surprised at how similar these meetings were. They wanted to know about themselves, about their own personal careers, what the future would bring for them. Many people are superstitious. Some will admit this publicly, but most will not. It is human nature to grapple with the powerful ideas of destiny, providence, and fate. Geller recalls going to Al Gore's house and telling him that one day Gore would be elected president. Reached for confirmation, the former vice president declined to comment. The following year, the association of divination with national security was once again in the news, this time involving the President of the United States. In May 1988, Donald T. Regan, former White House Chief of Staff, revealed in his memoir that President Reagan had sought the advice of a private astrologer during his tenure at the White House. Virtually every major move and decision the Reagans made during my time as White House Chief of Staff was cleared by a woman in San Francisco who drew up horoscopes to make certain that the planets were in favorable alignment for the enterprise. The revelation was stunning to some, perhaps even more so when the White House press secretary, Marlon Fitzwater, went before the cameras and confirmed the statement. President Reagan and his wife, Nancy, are both deeply interested in astrology, Fitzwater said. Others, like Washington Post reporter Sally Quinn, said it was simply a well-kept secret. I have known since before Reagan was elected president that they went to astrologers, and that's why I'm surprised at all of the surprise and shock. The astrologer was a San Francisco socialite named Joan Quigley. After it was revealed that Quigley allegedly cast star charts for the president, she became the subject of considerable public interest. In her memoir, What Does Joan Say?, Quigley wrote, "Not since the days of the Roman emperors and never in the history of the United States presidency has an astrologer played such a significant role in the nation's affairs of state." When a reporter with United Press International asked the president whether he believed that psychics could see the future, he said, "I've found it difficult to write them off entirely. The scriptures say there will be such people." The potential of prophecy as a military intelligence tool was also being investigated by the Defense Intelligence Agency under the Sunstreak banner. The classified project was identifiable inside the Special Access Program by its code name, Project P, as in prophecy. Graf and Verona were examining the possibility that remote viewing could be used as a tool to foresee future events. As per declassified documents, Project P was a utility assessment initiated to determine a remote viewer's ability to function effectively in a purely predictive mode. In 1987, the Persian Gulf was a particularly dangerous place, and America's military presence there represented the largest massed naval strength since the Vietnam War. Based on the premise that near-time exposure to future events might enhance remote viewer access to significant occurrences, e.g., the President Kennedy assassination, four remote viewers were conducted free-flight sessions against events of foreign intelligence significance in the Persian Gulf, reads a declassified Sunstreak report covering the winter of 1987. Free flight means that viewers functioned without the assistance of a monitor. When analysts at DIA reported that sessions were yielding weak correlations to the actual events, remote viewers' enthusiasm of Project P waned considerably. Upon review, it was suggested this project be held in abeyance pending completion of an in-depth review of this effort, according to DIA. There was more than enough work to keep the remote viewers at Fort Meade busy. In addition to sessions against foreign facilities targets, a new methodology was being developed for Project N1. This new utility assessment tested a viewer's ability to read a document remotely and substantially determine the nature of its contents. The broader military intelligence goal was to access and report against foreign documents with a reasonably acceptable rate of success. Declassified documents indicate that during training sessions, only two viewers successfully described the substantial content of the test document and provided conceptual drawings in support of their findings. Dale Graff confirmed that one of the successful viewers was Angela Della Fiora. The other viewer's number is not specified and could not be confirmed, which meant that she was assigned to many Project N1 operations, while other viewers were asked to continue training sessions with Ed Dames. This led to many of the same problems that had arisen the year before, namely that Dames was directing viewers to anomalous targets. Declassified documents reveal that in the winter of 1987, Dames tasked remote viewers to dozens of sites of celebrated UFO encounters and alien abductions. Paul Smith reports that many in the unit were fed up with Ed Dames's shenanigans and chafed at his parade of extraterrestrial targets, but official documents indicate that his folly seems to have had a Pied Piper effect on others in the unit, with many viewers following his lead. This is evident in hundreds of pages of declassified operations logs. One example of this kind of target assignment involved a visit to the J.M. Davis Arms and Historical Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma, with instructions that the viewer learn about an alien visitation alleged to have occurred there. In the log, Dames noted that aliens likely visited this museum to learn about human weapons technology. The gallery of guns included firearms from the 1300s, as well as ones used by Pancho Villa and Pretty Boy Floyd. In another example, on June 23, 1987, Dames sent viewer LB back in time to inquire about a possible UFO encounter and abduction at a Methodist parsonage in Midway, Texas, between hours of midnight and dawn. The viewer spent 2 hours and 6 minutes on the task. His report included contact with a long, rounded object covered with red and black, raspy, sharp points. For a while during the experience, the remote viewer reported feeling paralyzed. "A liquid, semi-solid, has me stuck in place." Dames's goal, he wrote, was to support his hypothesis that a group of extraterrestrials called the Supreme Galactic Council of Aliens was working to control Earth. With the help of other remote viewers in the unit, Dames sought to identify various alien bases already established on Earth, he said, including ones on Mount Hays in Alaska, in South America, and in Africa. Dames's anomaly targets were not limited to UFOs. He asked viewers to examine crop circles, to search for the lost city of Atlantis, to try to locate the Ark of the Covenant. He asked viewer 032 to go back in time to learn the truth about who shot President Kennedy, and to watch gladiator games at the Colosseum in Rome circa 79 AD. When an unidentified commander examined the data on these rogue targets, he wrote, Not verifiable, cannot evaluate, no ground truth. Military speak for the reality of a tactical situation, and had the reports filed away. Smith says a new Detachment G commander, Lieutenant Colonel William Zanakis, ordered Dames to lay off the bogus targets. While not excusing Dames's frivolous actions, which were performed at the taxpayer's expense, Atwater says he had witnessed enough strange behavior in his decade running the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade that Dames's targeting was not uniquely aberrant. Fred Atwater, just months from retirement, was also expanding his own supernatural ideas, he says, but insists they did not interfere with his professional life. Atwater had recently purchased a parcel of land at the Monroe Institute, where he would eventually serve as president. There, he would lead instruction in the Human Plus seminars, teaching clients how to communicate with non-physical entities who, according to conference-approved Monroe literature, were inhabitants of the distant future. Given Atwater's personal belief system, Dames's ideas were not so far afield. Whether they were appropriate for U.S. military projects was a separate issue. On November 26, 1986, Ed Dames had asked Paul Smith to remote view Titan, one of Saturn's moons, keeping the extraterrestrial nature of the target secret. Dames's goal, he wrote in the Sunstreak operations log, was to locate evidence that aliens lived and worked there. During this training session, Smith reported seeing land, water, and some structures in the target area, which Dames took as confirmation that this was part of an observation post on Saturn. When Smith found out that he'd been sent to an anomaly target, he was furious. "You have to remember, as viewers, we were like mushrooms," he recalled in 2016, "kept in the dark. We were blind to the target. We did not know if Dames was sending us to a real place or an anomaly. He was the operations manager. We went where we were told." Eventually, the information about the anomaly targets reached Jack Verona, DIA's head scientist at the Directorate of Science and Technology. Repercussions followed. Dames had originally been slated to replace Atwater after he'd retired. Verona denied the position to Dames and redesigned the branch chief position as a civilian job. The position went to Fernand Gauvin, a former viewer from the Tehran hostage days. He had been working in human intelligence as a civilian at INSCOM. The unit's morale took another hit, while viewer accusations about Angela Della Fiora continued to swirl. Some posited that she might have an eidetic memory and had memorized Earth's coordinates, which might account for her uncanny accuracy. A new protocol was put in place, one that had originally been designed by scientists at SRI back in 1985. Viewers would now be given what were called encrypted coordinates. For example, 20 degrees 34 minutes west, 48 degrees 13 minutes would be put into a programmable calculator and come out as 73082159, explains Smith. Because real coordinates are synonymous with real places, some of which were familiar to operations managers, the idea was that the encrypted coordinates would remove any level of cueing, either subconscious or intentional, and clear up suggestions about the system being gamed. Then, in late 1987 or early 1988, all members of the unit were summoned for a meeting. For the first time in Sunstreak history, a new training technique was going to be added to the Coordinate Remote Viewing, CRV, protocol. This new technique was called Written Remote Viewing, or WRV. Paul Smith was horrified. WRV means automatic writing, he observes, as in a tool of the occult. In an interview in 2015, Smith explained why this was intolerable to him. What this new approach accounted to, he says, was channeling. He'd been training in coordinate remote viewing for years. There were 6 stages to follow, each with its own specific set of techniques, Smith explained. Automatic writing was not one of them. Now, as if with the wave of a magic wand, a new protocol was being introduced by management, and he was certain Angela Della Fiora was behind it. Of the numerous occult practices, channeling is among the most maligned. It is generally defined as a process whereby an individual, the so-called channeler, speaks through an entity or a force outside themselves. A channeler is similar to a medium or a seer. Ancient history's most famous seer, the Oracle of Delphi, was a woman who would go into a trance and channel information for kings and generals. This figure was so important to national security that in 585 BC, Greek tribes fought the first sacred war to determine who would control it. The historian Herodotus indicates that Croesus, king of Lydia, visited the Oracle of Delphi in 560 BC to learn what his next conquest should be. Mediums, oracles, and seers have been around for millennia, but in the mid-1970s, the activity took on a contemporary twist when a young poet named Jane Roberts wrote a best-selling book, Seth Speaks, about her channeling. Now, a decade later, channeling was again part of the public discourse. While the WRV drama was unfolding at Fort Meade, ABC Television was airing the 5-hour miniseries Out on a Limb, based on Shirley MacLaine's autobiography, which included her work with mediums and channelers. The magician James Randi became so incensed with the channeling craze that he embarked on another hoax. This time, he created a fake channeler he called Carlos and took the young man on a tour around Australia to prove how gullible people are. Publicity material claimed Carlos was a young American artist named Jose Alvarez, who was able to channel a 2,000-year-old entity who had last appeared in the body of a 12-year-old boy in Venezuela in 1900. Audiences across Australia fell for the Carlos hoax. When the deception was revealed on 60 Minutes, Australian news outlets felt duped. Randy's point, he said, was that audiences were gullible and journalists were not doing their jobs. No one bothered to fact-check the story of Jose Alvarez, Randy said, and he had a valid point. People were easy to deceive. At Fort Meade, Paul Smith became angry during the meeting about written remote viewing. Automatic writing was channeling, and channeling was occult, he said. As Defense Department employees with secret clearances, it was their duty to know who their intelligence sources were, Smith argued. How do we know the entities aren't liars, pranksters, or evildoers, he asked. Who vetted them as intelligence assets? My misgivings were shared by nearly everyone else at the table, Smith later wrote. In his opinion, Angela Della Fiora was getting undue praise and attention. Now, it seemed, she was essentially being allowed to rewrite the rules. He was frustrated. He wanted to be useful to the Army. And he was tired of working rogue targets with Ed Dames. On May 15, 1987, Ed Dames tapped Smith on the shoulder and told him to get ready to head over to the viewer room for a session. Protocol forbade me from asking what the session would be about, Smith recalls. He figured he was in for another anomaly target, something or some place that did not really exist. Smith headed over to building 2560 and into the viewing room. He put on his Sony Walkman and hit play on a mixtape of hard rock. AC/DC came on, his favorite band, followed by Guns N' Roses, his second favorite. The lights went down in the room, and with music pounding in his ears, he began to relax. After the 20-minute cool-down period, Dames came into the room and sat down at one end of the long table, Smith recalls. Smith got out of his chair and sat across from Dames. What some viewers did before a session, Smith among them, was to make a list of anything that was bothering them before a viewing session began. This was a way to clear the mind of worries that could distract them from the task at hand. On this day, Smith's list was long, he recalls. His car kept breaking down, and bills were due. His wife had moved out 2 weeks earlier, and his three children were understandably upset and confused. Smith was over the proverbial barrel at this moment in his life. It felt good to get all this off his chest. When he finished the list, Dames recorded the date and time in the operations log, and the session began. It was May 15, 1987, 10:23 a.m. The coordinates came first. Smith saw land, water, then structure, he said, and wrote this down. He heard a clanging sound and sniffed a faint odor, he said, something like sautéed celery. After a few moments, he wrote down the words forbidding and taken aback. His hand began moving, and he sketched out a tall structure like a tower with steep stairs. He wrote tall and weapons. There was water. This was a vessel. The U.S. Navy was involved. In declassified logs, Smith made three similar drawings. Each unmistakably resembles a radar tower attached to a frigate or warship. Weaponry, water, stanchions, extrusions, braces, appurtenances, radar, Smith wrote in quick succession. He recalls looking up at Dames and seeing what appeared to him to be a lack of research protocols and laboratory controls. He was clearly bored, his chin resting on his hand, his eyes staring at the tasking sheet in front of him. Whatever I was reporting didn't seem to be what he wanted, Smith later wrote. This wasn't a UFO site, and Dames often appeared uninterested during sessions that had nothing to do with UFOs, aliens, or unsolved mysteries. Smith continued reporting what he saw at the target site. The vessel was a moving structure, he said. It had something to do with waiting and watching, and a magnetic envelope, whatever that meant. He saw people and got the word tasking. He wrote, reminds me of PSP, pierced steel planking, runway or flight deck of a ship. Then the session took a radical turn. Loud sound, he reported. Zzz sounds, he wrote. Sense of unexpected. Degree of occurrence greater than anticipated, effects pronounced. A dome of light, misidentification, accidentally on purpose, like a game of chicken, he said aloud and wrote down, troubling. Something had happened. The target was an event, some kind of an incident. He wrote, aircraft involved, U.S. ship, blinding crew and electronics. He finished the task, returned to the headquarters building, signed out, and went home. On Monday morning, as he was getting his children ready for school, the phone rang. It was Fred Atwater. He sounded agitated and wanted to know where Smith's notes were from the session on Friday morning. Smith said they were where they were supposed to be, locked in the office safe. Atwater told Smith to get over to the office fast. When Smith arrived, there was a newspaper on his desk. The headline read, 28 killed on U.S. frigate USS Stark. Didn't use defenses, don't know why, Navy says. The Stark had been patrolling within the general vicinity of the coordinates Paul Smith had been given by Ed Dames, off the coast of Saudi Arabia near the Iran-Iraq war exclusion boundary, when it was struck by two missiles fired from an Iraqi aircraft. 37 U.S. sailors were dead, 21 wounded. For reasons unknown, the ship's electronic warfare support systems had not detected the incoming missiles. Iranian Prime Minister Mir Hussein Mousavi called the incident a divine blessing and said the Persian Gulf was not a safe place for the superpowers. Smith reviewed his notes. He was stunned, he recalls. He had perceived the USS Stark incident 50 hours before it happened. He dedicated much of his recent life to the remote viewing unit. His marriage had suffered. It had reordered his sense of what was real. But precognition? Seeing an event before it happened? That astounded him. My impression had seemed real, he says. I was vicariously living an event that it turned out had not yet happened. Fred Atwater sent the details of Paul Smith's precognitive remote viewing session up the chain of command, where it was analyzed at DIA. But nothing came of it, says Smith. No positive feedback, no accolades, nothing, despite the fact that DIA was examining prophecy as a potential military intelligence tool, and that remote viewers were specifically asked to foresee future events of foreign intelligence significance in the Persian Gulf. When asked about this in 2016, Dale Graff said that it was hard to evaluate. When questioned further, he revealed that there were some religious issues involved, including with some members of Congress and their associates. For some in this group, says Graff, to hear about information received through extrasensory means was one thing. But to hear about remote viewers divining information about the future was considered heretical. As summarized in the 1987 Sunstreak report on Project P, except for a few isolated, eye-catching successes, there was no evidence of consistency or reliability in the results obtained from remote viewing efforts conducted in a predictive mode. Remote viewing the future does not appear to be a feasible or marketable aspect of this program at this time. Paul Smith's remarkably accurate prophetic viewing of the USS Stark incident would be filed away among the facilities targets, the Global Beacon tasks, and the imaginary research facilities on Saturn and on Mars. Chapter 21, Hostages and Drugs. In the mid-1980s, Americans and Western Europeans were being taken hostage by radical Islamic terrorist groups in the Middle East at an alarming rate. The remote viewers were detailed to help determine whether these hostages were dead or alive, and if they were alive, to help find them. The effort was called Project 8808. Over a 10-year period from 1982 to 1992, a total of 104 foreign hostages were seized, including CIA Bureau Chief William F. Buckley in 1984, Associated Press reporter Terry A. Anderson in 1985, and Church of England envoy Terry Waite in 1987. The kidnappers called themselves Islamic Jihad, the organization of the oppressed on earth, and Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine. Hostage testimony later revealed that almost all of the kidnappers were part of the same Shiite terrorist organization, Hezbollah. On February 17, 1988, Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Richard Higgins was abducted in Lebanon after meeting with the Amal militia, a local paramilitary group in the coastal city of Tyre. Higgins, who served as chief of the United Nations Military Observer Group Lebanon, was returning from a meeting to discuss procedures between local militia and the UN in the event of a kidnapping when he was pulled from his vehicle and kidnapped. His abduction was an international incident. At the Pentagon, it generated a crisis of some magnitude. Before joining the UN team, Higgins had served as a military aide to Secretary of Defense Caspar W. Weinberger from June 1985 until he went to Lebanon in June 1987. His in-depth knowledge of classified military matters made him a high-value hostage. Unlike a captured journalist or church envoy kept alive for leverage purposes, there was reason to believe that Higgins would be tortured to death by the Hezbollah terrorists in their effort to extract classified information. Time was precious. 4 days after the kidnapping, on a Sunday, Angela Della Fiora, Paul Smith, and Ed Dames were brought to the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center at Bolling Air Force Base in southeast Washington, D.C., to help in the effort. Inside a sensitive, compartmented information facility, the trio of viewers were shown satellite images and video footage, some of which was from an Israeli drone, uncommon in 1988, of locations in Lebanon, including a small village. Was Colonel Higgins anywhere locatable in these images? DIAC officials asked the viewers. Working the case was a DIA analyst named Louis André. He has never spoken to a reporter before. The nature of this operation was so sensitive, André said in 2016. There are many aspects that are still classified. What he could say was that before the operation began, I was highly skeptical of remote viewing. But this was a critical mission, and there was no room for pause, doubt, or distrust. There was strong reason to believe that Higgins' abduction had been carefully orchestrated by Imad Mughniya, the leader of Hezbollah's terrorist operations. Mughniya had overseen the 1983 suicide bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, in which 63 people, most of them CIA and embassy staff, were killed. And he had overseen the Beirut Marine Barracks suicide bombing 6 months later, a terrorist attack in which 241 U.S. service personnel were killed, including 220 Marines. In the 1980s, Imad Mughniya was considered one of the leading terrorist masterminds in the world. The DIA feared he was holding Higgins captive. Della Fiora was shown a map of a Lebanese village. She identified where she thought Higgins was being held, and she perceived him to be alive. She said Higgins was being kept inside a small structure. Imagery analysts told Dr. Verona that the area Della Fiora had pinpointed was a large, barren patch of land and that there were no structures there. Della Fiora said she was confident about the location, which was on a hill not far from a major road. Dale Graff had the analysts check the dates on the satellite images and learned that they were outdated, but newer photographs were not available. Smith and Dames also viewed targets with different results. After a long day of intense work, the viewers went home. Louis André suspected that working with remote viewers was a waste of time. But in another session, Angela Della Fiora produced phonetically the name of one of the Amal militia commanders involved in the Higgins case, providing details about his role in the region that were accurate. This included his role in the militia and information about his family members. It was astonishing, Andre recalls. These were incredibly sensitive components. He could not comprehend how Della Fiora could have accessed this information, only that she had. The work continued. 7 months later, in September 1988, West German hostage Rudolf Cordes was released by the terrorists. Cordes had seen Colonel Higgins alive shortly after his capture and confirmed in a debriefing with a U.S. official that he had been held captive in a specially constructed shed. Cordes also confirmed the small structure as being very likely near the barren location Della Fiora had identified that first Sunday after Higgins' capture. Andre came to accept that Della Fiora's information was valuable to the overall mission. Her talents continued to be applied, he says. The search for Higgins gained momentum over 113 sessions. Declassified memos indicate that Della Fiora perceived that Higgins was being moved from location to location and that he was on water. In March, Della Fiora continued to report that Higgins was alive and that he would eventually be released. Something about his feet would be a clue to investigators, she said. Della Fiora was wrong. Colonel Higgins was already dead. Intelligence agencies later confirmed that he had likely been killed between 4 and 6 weeks after his capture. Then it was learned that the terrorists had kept Higgins's body on ice to preserve it for reasons that would later be revealed. Higgins had been on water, says Dale Graff. It would be 18 months before the world learned the fate of Colonel Rich Higgins. In the summer of 1989, Israel Defense Forces captured Hezbollah leader Sheikh Obaid. 48 hours later, Hezbollah issued a statement demanding the return of the Sheikh or they would hang Higgins. When the Sheikh was not returned, Hezbollah released a video of Higgins's dead body with a noose around his neck. An FBI forensics team